A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi everybody and welcome to today's live broadcast. I'm delighted today to be here with Nick Knight from NK Active. He's a podiatrist and he runs a practice down in Hampshire, but he also offers online sessions. So wherever you are in the country or another country, you can talk to Nick about any of your physio-y, footy, leg-related, running-related problems, basically. Is that how you would describe yourself, Nick?
I think that's a very nice way. The more people get to know me, I'm not someone who's fussed around titles and stuff like that. The way I look at it, we're just here to help people get back from activity that they want to do. So if you're a runner, it doesn't matter if you want to make park run, or it doesn't matter if you want to go run an ultra marathon. You still have a goal, you still want to achieve it, and that's what we're here to help you do.
Fantastic. And today we're going to be talking about overpronation, because you and I had a little chat last week and it turns out that you've got loads of interesting things to say about it, and we're going to do some myth busting around the whole concept. So first of all, I really should say to you, what is overpronation? Just start with, I just want to jump right in there.
So the key to short and sweet is the honest answer, we don't actually know. It's one of those things that people say overpronate, but we don't actually know what normal foot motion is. So if we don't know what normal is, how can we define what over is? So actually, it doesn't exist. It's in its simplest form. And I should imagine we'll get on later chatting around about the myths around injuries and how the foot can relate to injuries and what pronation is and not. Because pronation is a normal foot motion. If your foot doesn't pronate at all, I am very, very worried, because you need your, especially if you're a trail runner, you need your foot to roll in and out to compensate for uneven ground. If your foot can't do that, you're in a heap of trouble. And actually, some people's feet move more than others. Sometimes it's not so ideal for those people. Sometimes the body doesn't really care. But the honest answer is, we don't know what overpronation is. What people think it is a flat foot, the foot that rolls in a lot. That's when people come to us, I overpronate, I have a really flat looking foot. But then also to throw another spanner into the works, what a foot visually looks like has no correlation to what that foot does when you run it.
Oh, so if you look like you've got really flat feet with no arch, then it doesn't necessarily mean you're like running like a flat-footed penguin type thing.
Yeah.
Okay, well that's really interesting. And so so it's basically really misunderstood as a concept, and we don't really know how much overpronation is good or not good. So am I right in thinking it's like pronation is basically when your foot like hits the ground when you foot strike, it kind of turns, does it? Or how would you explain the act of pronation itself?
as a clinician, technically what we call a tri-plane motion. So it's not just the foot rolling in, it's the foot rolling in, the foot going up, and then the foot pointing out as well. So it's this sort of motion. And just because a foot rolls in, that doesn't mean it's always going to push up and turn out at the same rate as at which it rolls in as well. And then people will often look at the end. So what happens at its maximum amount, but they don't often look at the journey from A to B. They often don't look at, well, where does that foot start? So if you've got a foot that is naturally a flat foot, and then you run and it rolls in a little bit more, or if you've got a foot that's, say, in inverted commas, a normal-looking foot, but rolls in slightly, but not as much as that flatter-looking foot, which one is overpronating? Because you may find, actually, the normal-looking foot's actually moving more, but it doesn't look as severe to the eye, but it's actually moving more. So that one overpronating, or is the other one overpronating? And this is why with this, just this whole big issue, and it's something that we've known in the medical world for about the last 15 years at least, that this is all one big myth. Mm-hmm. But it is still something, when you're talking in the athletic world, that is still very much spoke about, and it's still used to sell insoles and shoes and stuff like this, right? If you really want to bust one myth, if you've ever seen those pictures of, you've got someone with a flat foot and it looks like their knee's going in and their hip's going out, and then you stand on this insole and everything straightens up, that's just one big lie. It doesn't happen. It's just a load of rubbish. And the difficult thing to get your head around is that the amount, so if you were to put insole in the foot to try and, in inverted commas, straighten the foot up, to offload the muscles, you may not visually change what that foot looks like. So the foot could still roll in visually as much as an insole, but it can still have a positive outcome because it reduces the load going through the muscles. And this is what we'll say to people when we give them insoles in clinic, is we're not aiming to visually change what this looks like, because that may happen, it may not happen, but that hasn't got to happen to have a therapeutic effect.
Mm-hmm. I'm really sorry, I'm struggling to hear you, Nick. Is there any way you can be closer to the microwave? The microphone? And if you're watching live, just let us know if you can hear Nick or not. I can hear you, but it's like I have to really, really concentrate, and you're on the loudest thing.
One second, let me know. Yeah. Let me just quickly switch the microphone then.
Yeah.
Give me 1 second.
And we've got a couple of we've got a live question as well. If you've got any questions for Nick, if you're watching live, or later on as well, we can put them to him as well. If you put in the comments, then we can answer them now as well. Is that better?
Let me...
Oh, good.
Is that better now?
Everyone who's watching is saying they can hear you okay, and... Alan says he's loud here but a bit fuzzy. Yeah.
Is that, can you hear me better now?
Yeah, that's better. Yeah. There we go. Really good. Yeah. Sarah Bryan is also a podiatrist and chiropodist, and she says she was struggling to hear. So hopefully this will be fine.
Hopefully this will be better.
Oh, this is better. Yeah, I can hear you better. I hope everybody else can. There we go. There's about a 60-second delay on the thing, so hopefully everybody will catch up in a minute. Okay, so we've basically covered so far, in case people couldn't hear properly, that pronation is a natural thing, yeah?
Yeah.
And it's basically like this movement as the foot kind of rolls through, and no one knows how much is too much or not, and it depends on your body. And then some people will put you in insoles and try to straighten you up. But you were talking about flat feet before, and Trail Running Phil's got this question about flat feet for you just now.
Yeah.
He says, does Nick think people with flat feet can improve their arches, or are you simply born with a flat foot and can only develop your ligaments around your foot? Interesting question.
So yes, the answer is yes, you can improve it, but it means going under the knife and having very complex surgery done to the foot. Yikes. You can't really do anything to strengthen the foot to magically grow yourself an arch. But most people would have heard of, in the running world, would have heard of Gabriel Selassie.
Yeah.
He was rather efficient at putting one foot in front of the other very quickly. Mm-hmm. He has the flattest feet in the world.
Really?
But no one would ever change it because, what was he, could run a 2-hour 4, 2-hour 3 marathon or something around that time. So just because you got a flat foot, it's one of these things that in society we've been brought up, the flat foot's a bad foot. It's not a bad foot if it doesn't cause you any problems. And you're not more likely to get any problems than if you haven't got a flat foot. So with regards to the strengthening exercises, yes, that's important if you've got a flat foot, but it's also important if you haven't got a flat foot.
Yeah.
But you can't change with what you're born with. As I say to all my patients, you can choose your friends, but you can't choose your family. You can't change your genetics. You are what you are.
You can choose your friends, but you can't choose your feet.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So overpronation is a bit of a myth. And we have all these issues because we have a lot of shoe brands that say, oh, you overpronate, so you need this shoe, or you need this kind of medial post thing in here, and yeah, you need this, and you need this. Can we just talk a little bit about how shoe brands cope with this idea of overpronation and what we need to buy or not buy, yeah, in terms of shoes?
So shoe brands are improving. I have worked with a couple in the past, and they are trying to improve what they are providing as a product. And we have seen a change. So if you go back 5-7 years ago, you used to have a lot of these dual density shoes. So you had different densities of this high density foam called EVA. And the shoes to help with, in inverted commas, overpronation, used to have more higher density EVA than it less. So it used to support the foot. But now we know, actually, if you look at the shoes now, they're using a lot of like different variations of foam, and they're not using that dual density stuff. So they are moving away from that concept of categorizing shoes as the neutral stability support shoes. And I think this is where it all comes from, because we try to pigeonhole people and their feet into certain things, and it stuck. The frustrating thing is, we know it's not right, but we haven't got a very slick, simple solution. Like, a lot of people used to do what we call the wet footprint test. So everyone used to get out of the bath, stand and look at how much arch you can and not see, and then match it to the shoe. In principle, that was really, really simple. But in reality, it just doesn't work. And footwear brands are changing. However, when I was speaking to one of the brands we were working with, we said, we're trying to change, but obviously, what governs how we change is what consumers buy and what consumers want. So, for example, we know, for example, with footwear, we can eradicate laces. We do not need laces in shoes now.
Really?
The technology is there in shoes to have laceless shoes. They do it in football boots all the time now. The technology is there to have different fabrics that respond in different ways depending to the magnitude of load going through them.
Wow.
And we can physically do it. And I think it was Adidas did try to launch a laceless shoe, and it was a bit of a flop because no one brought it. So a lot of the technologies are there, but as consumers, we're not ready for change.
Ah, so we think we need overpronation shoes, so we'll go looking for an overpronation shoe to correct an issue which maybe isn't necessarily even there.
Yeah.
Like, but why, if people know they overpronate, like, is it because they think it's going to cause them an injury maybe, or
yes,
like, or they're having foot pain or something, and then they're thinking, it's overpronation? Is that
why people
are going for them?
100%. And it is sort of, people in the healthcare world, we're just as much to blame for this, because you'll still see posters, you'll still see clinicians talking about overpronation and you need support for this, when actually we know you don't. Some people do, some people don't, but not everyone does. So until everyone starts changing the narrative, it's never really going to change, because I can harp on about it and we can bust myths here, but we need everyone doing it to start getting that big culture shift from it.
What narrative would you like the overpronation narrative to change to then?
So I would like it to move away from sort of trying to link pronation to injury.
Okay.
And it, pronation has this very much bad sort of stigma attached to it. And it's not. And it's a lot of the time it's not actually related to someone's problem. In some people it may be. And the issue is we know from the research is that a foot that pronates has this overpronation, as it were, doesn't, you can't correlate that to someone getting an injury. It doesn't mean you're at an increased risk of getting an injury. Mm-hmm. If you have certain injuries, having a foot that pronates more than another foot may aggravate a particular injury. So if you've got an injury to the inside of your ankle and your foot rolls in, the more it rolls in, the more you're going to stress those ligaments. So if you're already injured, yes, it may not be helping, but it may not actually be related to why that injury happened in the first place. Mm-hmm. So if someone comes into clinic with us and they sort of said, oh, I've irritated a structure around my ankle, I think it's related to my foot pronation. And I said, well, we'll get speaking to them. But then they'll turn around and say, well, my mileage went from 20 miles a week to 100 miles a week. That's the issue. The foot is irrelevant to that. That's what we call a training error. Mm-hmm. And it's all about understanding what the body has capacity to tolerate. So in a nutshell, the stronger you are, the more sensible you are with your training, the less likely you are to pick up an injury. And that's not related to what your foot's doing. That's just injuries in general. But we can get very focused on this overpronation okay. bit. And even now, it's still a thing. I will have parents come in with their 3-4-year-old saying, got flat feet, need an insole to correct this. And we know that's not true, but it is still a thing spoken about, even though we know 15 years ago we disproved all of this, but we're still trying to change the narrative currently. But it doesn't help when you see adverts on social media of, you got flat feet, you must buy an insole, you must buy this. And it's just a load of rubbish. But you can see when someone has an injury, it's very easy to get sucked into that, and it's not the patient's fault at all. They're just wanting to get back to running, understand why this injury may have occurred, get back to the activities they want to do, and then maybe try and prevent it keep happening again.
And is there a case ever of people wearing an insole?
Why would you
wear a running insole?
So for me, is if you come in with no pain or symptoms, am I likely to give you an insole? No, I'm not, because you just adopt your policy, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Yeah.
Scenario. For me, it's the question you've always got to ask yourself when giving an insole, what's the objective you want to achieve by giving someone an insole? It may not be to reduce pain. It may be to help. So, for example, some people with knee pain find using an insole because it feels like it offers the foot a little bit more support that helps with the knee stability. Mm. So you're not maybe giving it for pain. You're giving it for someone feels more comfortable, someone feels more stable, then that helps them. If you then go out of the running community and then look into the elderly population at falls risk, we know insoles can help some people with balance to reduce the risk of falling. But it's always, if someone's speaking about giving you an insole, always ask the question, okay, what's the objective? Why are you giving me this? Mm. If they can't explain why, then maybe think about twice whether actually you need the insole or not.
Mm. That's interesting, because I've got a question from Hannah, who's one of our patrons, Hannah Neal. And she says she has high arches. So this is the opposite of the whole flat feet issue we're talking about. So high arches, narrow feet, and she overpronates, she says. She uses off-the-shelf orthotics, super feet, in her shoes, and it seems to work well. But she says, should she be trying to work on her arches not collapsing? Because it's what she's seen people advise her to do on Facebook. She said, disclaimer, I'm rubbish at keeping up with strength and conditioning.
And so I'll answer two parts of that. Is one thing, there's also the other myth, is that people think if you wear insoles, your foot's going to get lazy and get weaker.
Yeah, a bit like that's, when you wear glasses and your eyes are going to get weaker.
That's not the case. The insoles don't brace the foot. They just help support foot function. So we actually know you're not going to make anything weaker. So if you're using something like a super feet and you perceive there to be a benefit and you're not getting any negatives, there's no reason to stop using it unless you want to stop using it. So I wouldn't be have any fearful about, am I teaching myself bad habits and thing, everything on those lines. And sometimes the higher arch foot can be more difficult and tricky to treat than the flatter foot. And I fall into that category because in general, a lot of high arch feet tend to be quite stiff, which can make it, the foot has less tolerance to cope with things. And going back to the strength and conditioning bit, everyone has the capacity to be consistent with their strength and conditioning. It's just finding what makes that person tick. It's finding out that, again, not everyone needs to do the same strength and conditioning exercises. And we spoke about this before, and that it's about finding out what excites that person. What can they do? So whether it's a case of they go to the gym, whether they make a game out of it while playing with the kids, whether they do it while brushing their teeth, it's finding out what can someone do that it means it hasn't got to take time out of their day, and overcoming those barriers. Because you'll find that actually when you can become consistent with your training, when you come consistent with your strength training, that's when you'll often quite find that these aches and niggles just tend to be less frequent. As such, my advice to Hannah would be, well, continue using the super feet if you feel happy using it and they're comfortable and they're not causing any problems. You found a solution. If you perceive that's what you need to do to keep you running, then so be it. I wouldn't be looking at to upgrade those to a fully bespoke install, because if they're doing the job, then if it's not broke, don't fix it.
Yeah. But should she be trying to work on her arches not collapsing? Is that a thing?
Again, you can't do anything about that. The foot is, so what you can do though is work on your strength so the foot has more capacity to be able to do more without it. So the foot's going to do what the foot's going to do. You take the insoles out and the foot will go back to doing its normal function. The only time, three times that the foot function is really going to change, you either have surgery, you either have a large amount of trauma, or you start developing severe arthritis in the foot. They're the only times that that's really going to change, really.
Yeah, okay. So she doesn't need to worry at all, and she should just try and do some S&C and see how she can fit it into her day. Yeah,
and just enjoy her running.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's good. That's good to know, Hannah. Hope she enjoyed that answer to that question. She's going to be listening later. She can't. She's at work today. And we do have another question, actually, from Kat. She thinks she mildly overpronates and always used to wear support shoes. About 5 years ago, she started just wearing cushion shoes instead, and now she really likes Saucony Endorphin Speed 2s. Did she ever really need support shoes, or have they just changed over the years? Have her feet changed over the years?
Yeah. So I'm going to go out on a limb and say she mostly didn't need the support shoes in the first place. However, so we do something called 3D gait analysis in clinic. So we stick multiple markers to the whole lower limb and build a skeleton, just like out of Planet of the Apes and Avatar and what they use in Hollywood.
Cool.
Since doing stuff like that, I can most probably count on one hand over the 7 years of using it how many times I've recommended a support shoe to people.
Zero?
I reckon about two or three. times. But that was only because they had a certain foot pathology that was quite severe that needed as much support as we could get in there for them to keep them doing it. The thing that she's also like is actually she's mentioned a shoe, the Saucony Endorphin Speed, which is one of these. It has a nylon plate in it and has a rocker. And the geometry of that shoe will function completely different to any normal shoe. That shoe is almost similar to what Hoka stumbled on, and whether it was by accident or not, I don't know, because Hoka haven't ever really liked to work with the medical world. But having that slight rocker means that it gives you the ability to help push yourself slightly forward easier, and it helps improve something called sagittal plane function. And sagittal plane function is effectively the ability to drive yourself forward and how much your foot moves up and down, how much your knee bends backwards and forwards, and how much your hip goes backwards and forwards. When people speak about pronation, they speak about something what we call the frontal plane, which is how much it rolls in and out like this. And everyone focuses on that frontal plane, but But my perception is actually, I think sagittal plane is much more important.
Oh, so rolling forwards is much more important than the controlling of the moving sideways, because we should move a bit sideways anyway, because we should pronate. Is that, am I getting that right?
Yeah. So I think actually this is why we're seeing this bit of this craze at the moment with these plated rocker shoes and a lot of people liking them, because I think it helps facilitate function better.
Is that basically what those Carbon Alpha Fly 2,000,000,500 shoes do? The Nike ones and the reason why you see people running in, is that what they do? They ping, they basically ping you along. That's the technical term, isn't it? They ping you along.
Yeah. In a nutshell, do you know why they're called a 4% originally?
Oh, do they take 4% off your time?
You require on average 4% less energy to run
in those shoes. Surely that's cheating.
Well, so going off track slightly. So when Nike done all the studies on them, they found some people improved by about 3%, some people improved up to about 7%.
Wow.
And obviously from a marketing perspective, the Nike 3-7% shoe doesn't really ring off, whereas on average it was 4%. So that's why it was 4%. And there was the IAAF, I think it is, did come in and change, make some rules about the super shoes and what they can look like. Now, I am being completely cynical here, in that straight after those rules released, within literally a week, Nike had a shoe that was released commercially available that went up to the complete limit of those rules.
Wow, they must have known about that a year in advance.
Yeah, it's like it takes years to develop. You can't develop a shoe quickly.
No.
Because the rules were, is that I think the stack height couldn't go above 42 millimetres, mm-hmm. had some rules about the geometry, and it also had to be commercially available to buy.
Oh, okay. Being able to, it was 500 quid.
Yeah, exactly. So, me being a cynic, Nike obviously knew what the rules were going to be. And then it was a case of all the shoes for, it would have been, Beijing, the Olympics, had a race to get their shoes out to market so that athletes could use them in competition.
Yeah, wow. Well,
and I believe Nike even went one step further and said to some of the companies, well, actually, some of the athletes, we know you're sponsored by someone else, but if they don't get the shoe, we'll actually give you a shoe with no branding on.
Oh, and then you can use that.
And it's sort of like they're not breaking their contracts.
Yeah.
Wow. But everyone knew what shoe they were.
You can tell.
So
You don't need
sorry,
to
it's a little...
No, it was just making me think, because I'm just thinking about trail running shoes because of this being a trail and ultra running channel predominantly. So I haven't actually tried those like Alpha Fly weird ones with a pointy heel that make you look like a pixie. Trail shoes don't usually have anything to do with overpronation. They're like, it's a neutral shoe. The only shoe that I've tried that's had overpronation in it recently has been the ASICS Gel Trabuco something or other that I tested for T3 magazine. And it felt really stiff to me, this shoe, and I didn't actually, my foot ached after running in it because it was quite stiff and my foot felt like it was working hard to bend it, whereas usually you're in quite a flexible shoe that kind of molds to the train underfoot. I don't even know why we're talking about overpronation, because the trail running world doesn't even really recognize it. What would you say about that?
Well, the way I think about it is, if you're running on concrete, you're running on a repeatable, reliable surface every single time. The issue of trail running, your foot's landing in a different place, different position, different terrain every single step. So you're going to want the foot needs to adapt to the terrain that it's on. If you're running on a camber, if you're running over rocks, you're running over leaves, the foot and the shoe need to be able to adapt to that. So I think that's why they don't talk about it, because they realize it's not actually that relevant. But it's not really relevant in the road running scene either.
Yeah.
There is a couple of plated shoes coming out to help with trying to help push you forward more efficiently. The North Face Vective Flight Series is a shoe that I've got that I personally like, and they do have a carbon plate with a rocker.
Okay.
And for me, they personally help keep my calf issues under control, along with my strength and conditioning. But they are a firm ride underfoot.
Yeah.
Saucony did make an Endorphin trail shoe, but then they recalled it because I think they just made the rubber, the foam too soft, and the shoe itself. Sorry, can you hear builders in the background?
Yeah, I was just wondering if it was me or
next door neighbours.
Is somebody chopping someone's leg off? Is it an extreme case of overpronation there in the clinic?
Someone's been speaking about too much, and that was the punishment, is this sort of amputation. So my next door neighbour's converting their bungalow into a house.
Okay, I just wondered if it was outside my house or yours.
And it's sort of like they picked perfect timing while trying to do a live recording.
Whenever it's a nice day, I go out with my cameras to try and record a piece to camera with a nice blue sky in the background, and someone's chopping the hedge, someone's washing the car, someone's like, I don't know, building a wall, knocking something down. It's ridiculous. Mowing the lawn, that's a favourite one.
So it's not really a thing in trail running. It doesn't need to be, but I think it doesn't really need to be a thing in road running either.
Yes, yeah. So what should we be doing then? Like, are there like three major things that everybody can be doing to make sure that they don't have any injuries from like their foot strike?
So one is, don't worry about it.
That's a quick and easy one that we can all could do. That's a quick and easy one.
My mum always used to say to me, thinking's a dangerous game. If you overthink things, you can sometimes think yourself into a problem. So first of it, just go, don't worry about it, and just go out and enjoy it. When it comes to footwear, the best current advice we have is pick something that is comfortable. And making sure it is fit for purpose. The amount of people I see in clinic who sort of say, I'm getting problems, I'm out running, I'm doing trail running, but they're using a set of road shoes and they're just slipping over left, right and centre. Yeah. So it is making sure the equipment you're using is fit for purpose. And then the third point is almost a double whammy, is don't neglect your strength training and make any changes to your mileage nice and gradually. Some people speak about this 10% rule. I'm not a huge fan of it, but because if you're doing hardly any mileage, increasing by 10% is going to take you ages to get anywhere.
Yeah, that's true.
If you're in huge volumes, 10% could be quite a big change. Mm. But in its principles of just making changes gradually, whilst doing some strength training and wearing shoes that are comfortable and fit for purpose and enjoying yourself, are most probably some of the key things that help reduce your risk of picking up problems.
And when you're doing the strength training, there's loads of different strength training out there. You can Google like Wild Ginger strength work, and there's loads of workouts that come up. That another good person is Carla Molinaro, the Le Jog ladies record holder. She does a whole strength and conditioning.
Yeah.
Like it's her job basically, and it's a subscription service, and you get another one, a new workout every week. I thought it was interesting when we were talking about strength training, you were saying that people don't use heavy enough weights. I just wondered if there was certain exercises that everybody should be doing, and a bit of a chat around like how heavy to make things.
Yeah, so when we talk about weights and exercise, people often hear about, okay, you have to do 12 repetitions and you have to do 3 to 4 sets. Everything is 12 to 3, but we're all individuals. We all have different, if I was to do one exercise 12 times and you were to do one exercise 12 times, we'd both have a different experience. And it may be right for one of us and not the other person. So I prefer people to work on effort level, something that is called RPE. Mm-hmm. And that's a 0 to 10 scale, or you can use the Borg scale, which is 1 to 14. And if anyone out there has a running coach, then most of you would have heard about running to different effort scales, linking back to heart rate and etc. So we tend to say, when you're doing any exercises, always work to a 7 out of 10. Mm-hmm. And lifting weights perspective, that means that it's not easy, but when you finished, you could most probably do a few more reps. You got a few more left in the tank, but you couldn't keep going forever. Because from a physiological viewpoint, to increase strength, you need to make the exercise hard and not do many of them. So ideally, you want to drop the reps down to 3 to 6 repetitions, ideally 3, keep the effort level 7 out of 10 and do about 5 sets.
Oh, okay. So how come the exercises you've given me, I've got to do 8 to 10?
8 to 10 is because we haven't got the weights available to that. Oh, so we have to accept that if we were talking about 3 being the magic number, you need access to a gym to get that.
Okay.
So if we look at a continuum of what muscle strength and muscular endurance, doing sort of that 6 to 8 repetitions of something. Mm-hmm. And what we'll find yourself is it will often give people more to start with just to get them the habit of doing it.
Yeah.
And then once you're into a habit, we'll then up the resistance and drop the number of repetitions.
Okay.
Just because some people, if you give them heavy and low reps to begin with, they tend not to like it. So I need people to get the habit of doing something first.
And also, if they're not doing it correctly, you could kind of hurt yourself doing it with a big weight, maybe.
Possibly, yes.
Or just not doing it correctly, correct technique or something.
Yeah, the technique's often not too much of an issue per se with regards to injury. Mm. It's just you may not be getting what you want out of it. So you may not be using your time most efficiently, because most runners don't want to do strength training. If you give them a choice, do some strength training or go for a run, they'll pick go for a run every day of the week.
Every single time, yeah.
But the strength training, think of it as a tool to help facilitate you running when you want to run. And we know that actually, if you're strength training properly, 18 minutes, 1:8, 3 times a week is all you need to do as a minimum.
18 minutes, 3 times a week, strength training. Oh, I was only doing like 20 minutes once a week.
Yeah.
So I've got to do it. And would you do the strength training on the days that you run or not? Like if you're, say, you're running like 3 or 4 times a week, would you do the strength training on the non-running days?
Ideally, yes. But life gets in the way. So, for example, I ran a half marathon at the weekend, but I also play hockey. So actually, on my training plan, in an ideal world, my training plan wouldn't have been what I've just done. But to run my first half marathon, my highest mileage week was actually race week, because I had a league hockey league game the day before.
Yeah.
So all my training was like I was still lifting heavy weight. I didn't taper. So it's not the tech. It's by far the sterilized textbook half marathon approach, but I had to do what was worked for me. So sometimes, and again, when I've been looking at my strength training, I've sometimes had to do strength training session the day before a hockey match, which again isn't ideal, but with work, with kids and everything, that's the only way it works in my diary. Unfortunately, the majority of us out there aren't elite level athletes. We have to go to work to pay the bills, to buy new running shoes, to pay the race entry fees, to pay the hotel costs and everything on those lines. So it's a case of, yes, there's the ideal, but don't get bogged down into what happens if I sit outside the ideal, because we're not paid athletes. We're not paid to run for a living.
Yeah. Well, I was just wondering whether it's better to do, like, if you are going to do it on a running day, the strength and conditioning, like 10 minutes or so that you're going to do, should you do it before or after your run? And trail running Phil has made a really good point here. He says he finds a brief 10-minute session after a run is a good way of fitting the strength and conditioning in, because you're already warmed up and you're doing it just before your shower. So it kind of like just adds on a little bit to your run. What do you think about that? Or should you do it at the beginning?
No, there is no, it doesn't matter. Okay. From a body perspective, it doesn't matter. When you first start doing, so my only bit of advice is don't start strength training properly when you're about to come up to race day. Because if you do strength training properly, there's a risk you're going to get what we call DOMS, that delayed onset muscle soreness. And we've all had them as runners of, you've gone out, you push yourself slightly too hard, you woke up the next morning, the legs are just a little stiff and they just feel a little, and you may find that with strength training. But once the body gets used to doing that, so I'm in a position, well, I can do heavy weights before a hockey match and that doesn't really have any impact on my legs because I've been doing it for so long now, my body is just accustomed to doing that. It is used to doing that. So my advice is, It doesn't matter what time of day you do it, but I wouldn't start doing it sort of the week before a race. I'd wait until the race is over. Yeah. Hence why most elite athletes will, they won't look to increase their strength during race season. They'll just maintain it. Mm-hmm. And in the winter, mm-hmm. they'll then start lifting heavy again. And if it doesn't matter if they slightly overcook it because they haven't got a race in the diary.
Okay, so this is the perfect timing to be having this chat about the fact that overpronation doesn't really exist. You shouldn't really worry about it. Don't bother with stability shoes. Just do your strength training and train incrementally. This is the perfect time to be talking about it.
Yeah.
Because it's approaching winter, apart from the London Marathon this weekend.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know if anyone from watching this channel will be doing that kind of thing. But there's not tons and tons of trail races over the winter. It all kicks off again kind of April, really. So this is the perfect time, isn't it, for everybody to reassign, like redevelop their training plan based on this chat.
Yeah, exactly. So we've got one runner we help manage her strength and conditioning along with her running coach. And I think she's got the Clarendon Way marathon in this weekend. I think it was next weekend. And then after that, we're then going to be then hitting the weights hard with her because that's her season over then. So you used your winter period to get strong, and your winter running is normally really slow. Pace isn't about it, it's just about just getting miles under the belt sometimes, and it's just about just that super easy training. Use this time really now to build up that strength, because I can guarantee you, if you can do that, and then when you then start training for events again, you're going to go into it with a heap more energy. You're going to feel much better about yourself, and we see it all the time. Patients who have got injured, who've after seeing us, and we've taken them through this strengthening rehab process, will quite often then come back in their first event, run a PB, because all we've done, we've just made them fitter and stronger, more efficient athletes, and they then can run quicker for longer, and they're all really happy, because it's one of those things that I describe it, if you think of it, if you play tennis, you'd go have coaching, you're trained to play tennis. But running is very easy, just to go out and just get out and go. And that's one of the beautiful things about trail running, is that you can be just go out and go and forget about your work day and everything and just enjoy yourself. But we're never really taught about the importance of looking after yourself.
Yeah.
So yes, you do your strength training. Yes, you have your healthy diet. Yes, you're making sure you're getting adequate amounts of sleep. Those are the key things, not really worrying about the overpronation side of things. And it may be relevant in some people, but if we're talking en masse, the majority, you're better addressing what I call the bigger picture, which is the sleep, the diet, the training, the strengthening, because that's more than likely to have an effect on people. And a lot of patients will say, you've got this problem, what your foot's doing may be related to it, it may not. But there's also a chance, well, actually, if we just make you a little bit fitter and stronger, your body can cope with it better. So even if your foot is involved, it doesn't really matter because it's not causing you any problems anymore. So we don't need to worry about it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's really good advice. I thought we were going to be talking more about overpronation and pronation, but actually it's not really about it because it doesn't exist anyway.
No.
So we're talking about strength and we're talking about training gradually, upping the training gradually.
So if we talk about overpronation, there was a colleague of mine, Ian Griffiths, who made a nice diagram once. And if you imagine you're in a lift and you've got three floors up and three floors down. And if we say the higher you go, the more overpronation you get, the lower you go, the more supination you get, which is the opposite, the rolling out. If you have someone starting at level two and they end at level three, so the maximal, the flattest as a flat your feet can get, they have moved one level. If you have someone that starts at minus three and ends up at zero, so a foot that looks completely normal, people will say the first instance, the one who's moved one level is an overpronated foot, but actually it's only moved a small amount. Actually, if you're talking about pronation, the one that started on minus three and gone to zero has actually moved a lot more. But visually, when you look at it with the eye, you can't tell that. And this is part of the reason as to why there are so many myths out there about it, is that I think when we look at overpronation, we're asking the wrong questions, and we're looking at the wrong things. For me, I'm more worried about, if you are going to look at it, how long someone spends in that position and the speed in which someone does it. So if you looked at Gabriel Selassie, every slow motion running, yes, his foot moves a lot and it's super flat, but it always looks so beautifully controlled and nice and slow. And the body will adapt and cope with that really, really well. But if you get something that moves really, really fast, the body doesn't like it because it's a sudden change of movement very quickly. So the muscles and the tendons have to work a lot harder to cope with that velocity, that speed of motion. So this is the thing why it gets awfully complex, because in the research, I think we've been asking the wrong questions a lot of the time. And then I think when we then look at it from trying to buy a running shoe, we're looking at one small thing and we're forgetting the other 80% of everything else that's going on.
Yeah, it's like we want a quick fix. We want to buy a shoe to fix the problem, when actually, yes, we've got to spend 20 minutes three times a week doing some kind of boring work.
Yeah.
Put the and the thing, on.
Yeah, and it is one of those things that there was a study done, and I think it is, they asked a load of runners around about what you contribute towards injuries and what's the first thing you do.
Yeah.
And I think it was in the high 70s or even higher.
Yeah.
They went and changed their shoes. Everything was blamed on the shoes. Yeah. I need new shoes.
Yeah, it's a quick fix, and it's, you know, it's something, yeah, you can easily do and feel good about and spend money on. And you're like, yes, I've done this and there we go. Or you pay a physio and you pay them to put your hips back straight and pummel you about a bit, make some things hurt, make some things, ease, yeah, some things off. And you think, yeah, done that, sorted. They give you a list of exercises. You're like, nah, don't bother them.
Yeah, and it's the exercise that's the important part. And we go back to the runners and shoe thing, is that the research shows, I think it's less than 10%. Of actually running related injuries are related to footwear.
Yeah.
So there's this massive disparity that runners believe everything's related to footwear when the science doesn't,
yeah,
support that. And that's the same thing we're having with overpronation.
Yeah.
The issue is there's a lot of healthcare professionals that haven't kept up with it, shall we say?
Oh, okay.
And there's also some that it's very easy to see a flat foot and flog someone an insole.
Yeah.
And say, you need this. But a lot of the time, that's not.
Yeah.
So I will come in, I'll see patients, they'll come in with a bag of insoles, literally a carrier bag. Wow. And they're like, I need another insole. And I'm like, you've literally got 20 pairs in there. The last thing you need is another insole that's going to sit in that bag and not work.
Yeah.
For you. But again, it goes back to, it's that quick fix mentality. Someone sort of giving you a quick rub down and whatnot and saying, off you go.
Yeah.
But actually it's getting down.
Yeah.
And I think it comes down to an education thing. Education is key.
Yeah.
We're
not cars, are we? You can't take us to the mechanic and they fix us and then we go out shiny and new again. Yeah.
Yeah. My life would be so much easier.
If people were like that.
But it'd be boring. My job would be boring.
Oh, well, I hope you've just got a few more minutes with us, Nick, because
we've
got three questions coming on the live chat. So Saragan McKenney says, are there certain types of no equipment activity that can improve strength? Like, what would your top no equipment strength moves be?
Yeah. So when we say no equipment, everyone actually has equipment. Everyone has a bag for life. Everyone most probably has hundreds of bags for life at the moment, because we've all been to the supermarket, forgot them and had to buy another one.
Oh, yeah.
And we're in clinic and we actually put 60 kilograms in a bag for life and it didn't break. And we, so you have tins of baked beans, you have empty bottles that you can fill with water. And the beauty of water, you know, a liter is a kilogram.
Mm-hmm. We do now.
Yeah. And I would say wine bottles, but if you've got hundreds of empty wine bottles, then there's another issue going on.
You need to take a long, hard look at yourself.
So you can actually do stuff around the house with that. And for me, if you're going to think of three core exercises, it's an exercise that looks at the gluteals, it's an exercise that looks at the calf, and then it's an exercise that maybe looks at the quads or hamstrings. region. So for me, calf raises should be in this one of the staple exercises all runners do. And that's straight knee calf raises and also bent knee calf raises. Now, the bent knee calf raises actually can be very difficult to do, which is good. You want an exercise that is hard. And you also want someone to feel like you've done an exercise. Yeah, that was hard. I've had a bit of a workout. You get that endorphin rush. You feel good about yourself because you feel like I'm doing something positive. If you can sit there and bash out 100 or something, you're like, oh, I'm bored now. I'm not going to do it. And you won't see the benefit. But to do bent knee calf raises, you normally need to use a towel, a belt, a bit of rope, something where you can then really lean back, squat, try and get that knee to 90 degrees, and then start doing calf raises with a bent knee. Now, the reason why I think that is one of the most important exercises is if we look at the calf, the majority of people have two calf muscles, some have three. And if you look at the main two, gastrocnemius is the most superficial one. So if you look at your leg, you move your foot up and down, that's what you can see moving, gastrocnemius, and you'll see there's two bulges, two heads to it, and that's the most superficial. Sitting behind that is a muscle called soleus. Soleus gets forgotten about, and in my eyes, is quite often the root of all evil. Because when you look at how hard those muscles work, gastrocnemius, I think, is about 3 times body weight on running. Soleus is 8 times body weight on running. So it works a lot harder. So every patient we see in clinic who has plantar fascia issues, Achilles problems, when we look at their soleus, there's always some strength work to be done on that. And that's what, and the reason why you have to bend the knee is just to bore people with a bit of anatomy. Your gastrocnemius actually starts its life above your knee. So if you bend your knee, you get a crease down the back of the knee, gastrocnemius starts above that. So if you put a 90 degree kink in your knee, so bend the knees 90 degrees, you basically inhibit that gastrocnemius from working, and you do a calf raise with a bent knee, that means you're just isolating soleus. Then there's also a great exercise is what I call banded walks. So you can get hold of, and I think I've sent you some, Claire, some little bands.
I'm literally doing my exercises under the desk as we speak. Yeah. Because it reminded me, oh my goodness, I haven't done them today.
And you can do little exercises with those bands. So yes, it is a bit of equipment, but that literally can fold up and go in your pocket.
You get them from Nick's website. I'll put a link in the film description below or the podcast notes. Oh, there's a nice picture of Nick on here. They sent it to me. Oh dear, my whole address is on there. Whoops.
Oh yeah.
Don't be sending me sound mail, everybody.
So you can do what I call lateral band walks. So that's literally put them around your feet, you bend your knees, and you crab walk across your dining room, your kitchen, wherever. And that's a great exercise to get the glutes working.
Oh, going like one foot, like going right.
Right foot, left foot,
but just going right all the time. Okay, like a crab walking sideways. I see. Yeah.
And then go the other way. I've got videos of all these exercises. I can send them to you, and then you can then send them out to people.
Well, if anyone wants to book in with you, then they could get a whole review of what they need to do, can't they? Because it must be slightly different for everyone. But so calf raises, bent knee calf raises, and this crab walk with a resistance band. So they do need a little bit of kit.
And then the final one would be squats.
Oh, okay, squats. With the 60 kilogram bags.
Yep, ideally. Or if you haven't got a bag for life and some food or water, doing some a really good exercise, a really difficult one, is something called a Bulgarian split squat. And that is basically you will put one foot on your sofa, your bed, and you rest the top of your foot on there. You then basically, with the other foot, step forward. So you're stood up with one leg straight and the other foot bent, resting on your sofa. Keeping that foot on the sofa, you bend your knee of the straight leg until your knee of the bent leg touches the floor, and then you drive yourself up.
Wow.
That's a fantastic exercise. It's difficult to do. You can make it harder by adding weights and everything on those lines. But I like that because that's a single leg exercise. and you get a bit of quad workout, you get a bit of glutes, you get a bit of hamstrings. So that's a really good sort of ticking a lot of boxes.
Cool. Okay, that one sounds a bit complicated. I think if you do give me the links to those exercises, I'll just give them to patrons. So if anyone's a patron of Wild Ginger Running YouTube channel, then you can access these exercises and do them 3 times a week, as Nick is suggesting.
Yeah,
that is fantastic. We've got 2 more questions. Is that okay?
I've got time.
Today's you Cantwell says, "What are Nick's views on shoes with an arch versus zero drop shoes?" So it's kind of comparing two completely different things there.
So the zero drop craze sort of went off with a book called Born to Run, and it was like, and then you had the Vivo barefoot, and then there was this whole sort of like, barefoot's great, maximum shoes are bad, and there's this whole sort of beef between the two form, when actually it doesn't matter. It's wearing barefoot type shoes will not reduce your risk of injuries. Wearing normal shoes will not reduce your risk of injuries. You just get different injuries.
Oh, really?
So we tend to find people who wear barefoot, the most common injuries I see people who barefoot run is calf, Achilles, ankle related issues. Mm-hmm. And then the higher the drop you go on the shoe, the more people come in with knee or hip problems.
Okay.
So you just transfer the load to different places. Mm-hmm. The load going through the body is a constant. Mm-hmm. So I have got nothing against barefoot shoes. My only advice is, if you want to transition to barefoot shoes, take around 4 to 6 months to gradually progress out of normal shoes into barefoot shoes, because it is a big change for the body. And if you do it any quicker than that, you just increase your risk of getting injured. And for example, if you've had someone who's had a neuroma before or a fractured metatarsal, then possibly doing all your stuff in barefoot shoes may not be the most sensible thing. Because the biggest risk of having an injury is having a history of that injury before.
Mm-hmm.
They're not bad. It's just horses for courses.
Yeah.
It's like, for me, I've naturally had calf issues in the past. I've got very stiff feet. I keep up on my strength training, but my foot type and my body, I just don't fit a zero drop shoe that well. I need something with a rocker, or I need something with a heel raise, a higher drop, because that suits my body better.
Yeah.
It's almost like Cinderella. Like, we want to pick the brands, we want to pick the shoes, but actually the shoe will pick you.
Yeah. And you've got to try about that many, haven't you, before you actually find the right one.
Yeah. You've got to try all hundreds.
Pile of shoes behind me.
Yeah.
Oh, thanks. Nick, that was a really good answer there. I hope that answered your questions, Taduce. And Bryony A said, "Sorry, missed the beginning, and this may have already been covered, but she supinates. I don't know if we've covered anyone who supinates before. She says she has high arches. I don't want to use special insoles. Do I have to, or can specific strength work help my niggles?" Oh, I think we have answered this basically. What would you say?
So in a nutshell, everyone supinates, everyone pronates. It's a normal motion, so don't worry about it too much. You don't need special insoles all of the time. You may find there are different things in that strengthening work, gait re-education, different shoes can be helpful. The way we describe it with patients, it's almost like you've got all these different ways to treat different things. It's about picking the right tool from the hypothetical toolbox to give you the solution to help resolve the problem that you have got. And there'll be some people that are happy to use insoles. There'll be some people who don't want to use insoles. And that's not a good thing. It's not a bad thing. But it doesn't mean it's like every door is then shut. There are still other things that you can do. So, for example, I'll wear insoles for hockey, but that's the only time I wear insoles. I don't wear insoles at any other time because I need, my foot seems to like them when I play hockey, but I can run a half marathon and I don't need them. I can go do strength training. I don't need them. So I think there's a lot of education to be had about what an insole can actually do for people. But if you've got a supinated foot type, no, you don't always need an insole. But actually doing some strength training could definitely help get rid of the niggles. And a lot of the patients we'll see will lay all this out to them, and they're like, well, actually, can we just get a little bit fitter and stronger first? And then if I still got the niggles, go down the insole at a later date. Because you may need the insole, you may not, but being a bit fitter and stronger is never a bad thing.
Yeah. And when you know, like if somebody was to come to you and book an appointment, and you sort of gave them these exercises, you analysed it, you gave them the exercises to do, you talked about training with them, how long would it take to see any kind of changes, do you think? How long do people have to stick at this?
So you have to stick at it for a good 12 to 14 weeks.
Okay.
So the structure we would do, if you go through a rehab program with us, we audit all our own data in clinic. So we know on average it will take you 5 sessions over at 14 to 16 weeks to get you to where you want to get to. But what we tend to find is that the first 3 sessions have to be done within a month, because there's a lot of questions. There's a lot of anxiety and fear about re-injury and everything on those lines. And then what we find after that, once people understand it and learn a bit more, you then leave it longer and longer between appointments. Because the aim is, from our perspective, is to teach you how to manage this yourself and show you why this is important. You then see the differences in performance, you see the differences in the symptoms settling down, and then you understand why it's important. As soon as you understand, you get what I call that emotional buy-in. Once you've got that, you will always do some form of strengthening work, because in your head, it's worth the time investment to help you run more often.
Yeah.
And we know if you follow that process, our own data set shows us that, well, there's about a 97% chance, if you follow that protocol, that you'll get what you want out of it at the end.
Fantastic. And so where can people find you? If people have been listening to this today and they're like, oh my goodness, I must have a chat with Nick. I've got to sort out all my niggles and make me run stronger and happier for the rest of my life. How should people find you and follow you?
So they can just type nkactive.co.uk is the main website. Nkactive on Facebook, Nkactive Clinics on Instagram, and Nkactive Clinics on TikTok.
TikTok. Oh, I haven't even done TikTok yet.
Yeah.
<It's>, you're there with your dancing. Are you dancing?
I'm not dancing, no, whatsoever. It's sort of that may get attract a lot of attention, but for the wrong reasons.
It might go viral, you never know.
Yeah.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Nick. It's been really lovely to chat to you today. Thank you for giving us just over an hour of your time. That's been brilliant.
Anytime.
Yeah. Thank you so much for talking to us about overpronation. I believe we've got you back to talk about strength work in particular at midday on Thursday, the 27th of October. So we'll delve a little bit deeper dive into the world of strength work then. We'll be putting some of these strength work moves that you mentioned up for patrons later. So if you're a patron, you'll benefit from that, for a patron of Wild Ginger Running. But if you are interested in getting a session with Nick, then just go on his website, and you do them online, don't you, via Zoom? So you can can't see anyone from anywhere.
Yeah, anyone. But we've got 4 patients in the US at the moment, 1 in Australia. So.
Sure.
Yeah, or I say we're based Southampton, Romsey area. So if people want to come in face to face, then we do that as well.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much, Nick, and we shall be seeing you soon.
No, thank you very much for asking me to come on.
Cool. See you, everybody. Thanks you. Thank you for all your questions. And
see you later.
Yeah, we'll see you soon. Thank you, guys. Bye.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.